This is Close Reads,
a philosophy podcast with Mark and Wes.
I'm Wes Alwyn.
And I'm Mark Linsenmeyer. It's time for a new reading. And I had suggested another article by Donald Davidson. I feel like when I initially read him, I felt like this is maybe the best philosopher I've ever read. I felt like the most cogent, the most subtle. I don't feel that after our recent partially examined life exploration of him. But I was still curious to read a little bit more. Yeah, what was your overall reaction to this guy?
He's great. The things we read are a bit dense, probably. They could use a bit more explication, but maybe not for the audience that he's writing for in a particular journal. At that time, he's overall a really good writer, and he's obviously, you know, a great thinker. So there's only a certain amount of analytic philosophy I can take. So I'm a little worried that you're going to try and, because of your course, death march us through a lot of analytic philosophy of mind, but we'll see.
Yeah, I don't know. I sort of think of these contemporary, I think of the analytic, well, obviously like Williamson is core analytic, and that's very contemporary. But I put Williamson in an entirely different category, and maybe closer to Davidson than Chalmers and Fodor and Dennett and people like that. And I'm not sure why that is. Maybe it has to do with the relationship to science, or just the relationship to these being live public issues. I guess Ned Block is a good one, who is a really sharp, you know, writer in that area of philosophy of mind, mm-hmm. who is still really difficult, who is still, you can't nail down. He's not fun like Chalmers is. He's still scathing like Dennett is, but I find him harder to nail down. And he definitely is not as afraid to go off into mathematics territory. So maybe that is the line. Are you really an analytic philosopher if you're not in mathematics territory?
Mm-hmm.
I also felt the same way in terms of, okay, this is to the point. It doesn't require me to have a lot of background. It's just a really insightful, subtle, carefully thought thing about Nagel. So when people would ask me, what is your, you know, what is the one book that you would just recommend for a beginning philosopher? And Nagel's Mortal Thoughts, a collection of essays. I have long felt like I want to actually, maybe we should go back to some of those, not necessarily related to philosophy of mind, but for this podcast. I remember he has one about the absurd in there. I forget what else, but you know, nuggets that was kind of what I liked about analytic philosophy as opposed to Hegel. Hegel, you don't understand it. You're struggling with the words. With good analytic philosophy, you're not struggling with the words. You're just, it just gives you, you know, actual things to think about.
Yeah, let's get into it.
All right, so this article is called First Person Authority. It's from 1984. I don't even remember how, I just stumbled over this yesterday, and I don't even remember how exactly, but it seemed, why don't you read the summary, Wes? It has a little summary in three languages at the top.
Okay. What explains the presumption that a speaker is right when he sincerely attributes a belief, desire, or intention to his present self, while there is no such presumption when others make similar attributions to him? It is argued that solutions to the problem of knowledge of other minds, which merely restate the asymmetry, leave open the field to the skeptic. A new explanation of first-person authority is offered, which traces the source of authority to a necessary feature of the interpretation of speech. Yeah, this attempt to languageify, you know, already has me skeptical, but we'll see.
Yes. Well, I mean, we know sort of the general background of this, which is Wittgenstein's private language argument. You know, do you know what you mean? Can you talk about your individual pain that nobody else can get a hold of? And the very fact that you put it in this public word, pain, makes it in some way accessible to other people. They can't see your pain. You could be lying about your pain. It seems like you can't be wrong. Well, Are there, for psychoanalytically, like, right, there are phantom pains, there are hysterical
pains.
Yeah,
but that's
not. But you're still feeling the pain, yeah. Right? You were right. You can't be wrong that you're in pain.
Yeah. I think the thing here, you know, just the overall move, right? Ironically, the appeal to a necessary feature of the interpretation of speech, just take that phrase, you can already see that that's a kind of the go-to analytic replacement for introspection. It's like, well, we're not going to introspect, but we're going to talk about language and semantics and syntax. And we're going to do all this stuff with language that we used to do by just thinking about the mind. But we'll see. I may be, this is just completely prejudiced premonition. We'll see what Davidson. Well, you know already because you read it.
I haven't read this yet.
Oh, I thought you read it. Okay.
Nope.
All right.
When a speaker avers that he has a belief, hope, desire, or intention, there is a presumption that he is not mistaken, a presumption that does not attach to his descriptions of similar mental states to others. Why should there be this asymmetry between attributions of attitudes to our present selves and attributions of the same attitudes to other selves? What accounts for the authority accorded first-person present tense claims of this sort and denied second- or third-person claims? The point may be made and the question asked either in the modality of language or of epistemology. For if one can speak with special authority, the status of one's knowledge must somehow accord. While if one's knowledge shows some systematic difference, claims to know must reflect the difference. I must assume, therefore, that if first-person authority in speech can be explained, we will have done much, if not all, of what needs to be done to characterize and account for the epistemological facts.
Okay, so this sounds more like a regrounding or a reduction. So he is going to argue for first-person authority, but he's going to try to ground it in language. So the epistemological facts, which is what he's, right, the traditional way of approaching this in philosophy, will get this language grounding.
Right. There's this question of, to what degree do we understand ourselves without language, right? Can we have, we've talked before about, can there be thought at all without language? And inevitably we start talking about dogs and things like, does the dog certainly believes that you're going to bring his or her dinner, believes, you know, that you're about to come home, believes all these things, but yet doesn't have the language to say that, but somehow even has to have the concept of you as, you know, the master. Maybe it's a smell-based concept. Maybe it's not even based in images. Or is this real thought? Does having a language make you a fundamentally different kind of creature regarding your own, certainly regarding your own self-reflection, right? That the dog cannot think about, I am believing that somebody is coming home. But can the dog think that, like, can dogs hide things from each other? You know, if you're trying to sneak up on a prey animal, then it seems like you have at least behavioral equivalents of beliefs that they don't detect me yet. And then when they start sprinting, then the subterfuge is over. So it seems like they have some sort of crude theory of mind, if it's not entirely reflex, which it seems like it's more reflexible than that, so it can't be reflex.
Yeah. They certainly don't have theory of mind in our sense, which we know, which is basically about an understanding that others can have different beliefs than ours and they could be wrong about them. But yeah, they seem to have something. And I think concepts are largely dispositional, you know, as per meaning as use. Dispositions to behave in certain ways and say certain things. This makes me sound more behavioralistically analytic than, you know, you might expect, but I think this is part of it. And in that way, they're similar to character traits and something I've been thinking about with psychoanalysis. So there's not an easy way to disentangle concepts and the self, ego, right? Development, ego structure. Concepts are part of our structure and they operate non-consciously, but we can become conscious of them and language is the way to do that, I think. And then you were just to finish what you were asking, like, can we be mistaken that we're in pain? I don't think we can, of course, because if we're, you know, someone's going to say, ooh, I'm the evil genius. I'm going to give you the illusion, the delusion that you're in pain. And you go, ow. And of course, Al is you are in pain. The in some cases illusions and the real thing can't be distinguished. But if you're into psychoanalysis, you could say, well, the person doesn't know why they're in pain. They have a bad theory of their pain. They think it's because they wanted the piece of cake and, you know, mommy said no. And that may be part of it, deprivation. But really, it's because they were offended. It's the pain of, you know, Aristotelian slights and anger, what psychoanalysts would call narcissistic injury. So I think we can be wrong about the nature of a pain, very, you know, and badly wrong, and that can make it worse. So just to go back and answer your question a little bit. So that does add wrinkles and complications ultimately to these views, I think.
Well, and I would add the distinction between a mere feeling and an emotion. So pain, we normally think of as a mere feeling, but I'm thinking about when a child has a little tiny scratch, and is the child going to completely lose it and throw a tantrum? Or is the child just going to get up and keep moving? Like, you would think that the pain is probably the same either way, but the expression of the pain, and then that, you know, the narcissistic injury.
Yep.
It's so unfair that the world is this way that I should be in pain.
Yes. Exactly.
You know, oh, parental figures, yep. I need to show you and share with you this pain. You know, it's like I'm pointing out the pain. Look, there's the pain, you know. Because I want to get. So to say that doesn't change the experience, it seems naive. Clearly,
right.
You know, it's a much more intense pain, but yet the facts on the ground and maybe the facts of the actual sensation are not any different.
Yeah, I mean, this is really an odd thing, and it speaks to the Stoic insight, right? The Stoic intuition, which is that we can have these propositional attitudes, these beliefs that do change the qualia, the phenomena, or do they? I mean, that's a paper. I'm sure it's been written many times, but do they, and how do they do it? And yeah, they certainly make it worse, right? The child example you're giving, yeah, I think we'd have to, our default view would have to be, yes, it does change the qualitative feel of the experience. It doesn't just add on other qualities, right? But anyway, that bears a lot of thinking about.
All right, go.
The connection between the problem of first person authority and the traditional problem of other minds is obvious. But as I pose the former problem, there are two important differences. First person authority is a narrower problem, since I shall consider it only as it applies to propositional attitudes like belief, desire, intention. Being pleased, astonished, afeared, or proud that something is the case, or knowing, remembering, noticing, or perceiving that something is the case. But I shall not discuss what are often taken to be central to the problem of other minds, pains and other sensations. No! And knowledge, memory, attention, and perception as directed at objects like people, streets, cities, comets, and events rather than propositions. He's always got to include something astronomical, you know. What holds for the propositional attitudes ought, it seems, to be relevant to sensations and the rest. But I do not explore the connection here. There's the problem of the other minds, and then there's first person authority. Problem of the minds, how do we, you know, I can't just say what's in your head and I can't experience it, and I don't have direct knowledge that you even have something in your head. The problem of first person authority is whether I can say that I seem to have a pain that I don't have or something like that. If I don't have that first person authority, I might have pains that I may not have pains that I think I have. All right. But here he's going to leave aside pain, and then he's only going to consider propositional attitudes.
And I don't know that knowing should be included in here, because knowing is an achievement term, whereas believing, remembering, noticing. Well, noticing maybe is like knowing. But in any case, it seems that I just was reading last night, looking at another possible paper for us to read by Jerry Fodor about methodological solipsism. And the idea was there are these externalists about belief that think that you need to understand the context in which someone is put to even say what the content of their proposition is. That if they're in a different environment, then what they mean in their head could mean something different. And it seemed like that raised, I didn't get that far into the photo or paper to know, but it seemed like that raised too many problems. Like when you're studying the kind of thing that Davidson is going to be studying here, you need just detach it. Have an epoche, we're going to put aside whether the belief is true or not. It's just, are you correct in ascribing a belief to yourself? Mm. And are you, as compared to your level of certainty and warrant in ascribing a belief to somebody else?
But a propositional attitude is, you know, an interesting way to go, right? Because it's non-traditional. And because it doesn't, like, the extent to which it carries qualitative content or qualia with it is disputed and unclear.
Yep.
Right. To have a belief itself is not to say I necessarily bring up, you know, I believe that the cat is on the mat. Doesn't, right? It certainly isn't the same as having the experience that the cat is on the mat or the dream or even imagining it. You know, if we're reading at a quick pace, we're reading all these propositions without putting images to every single one of them, probably. So this is something that, right, he gets away from qualia here. And I guess that makes it easier. I don't know.
I mean, we'll have to see whether these beliefs, desires, intentions, whether these are dispositions, in which case, I don't know what my dispositions are in many cases until something, the inciting incident that would make that disposition actualized comes to case. You know, would you run from a bear attack? Like, do you believe that bears are so dangerous that you need to run away from them? Or do you believe, you know, what they tell you, that, oh, just yell at it and that'll make it run away? You know, I don't know.
case from this sentence, right? He uses the word problem, and it's not necessarily something I'm going to put an image to, right? So what does it mean to say I know the meaning of it? Well, I have dispositions to use it in certain ways in certain sentences and to know if you're using it the wrong way in certain sentences, it'll be like, what? What's he saying? And so that's the beginning, you know, of sketching out a dispositional account of what it means to have a concept in this case. And it's, of course, it, you know, I think it runs against our intuition. Well, you know, if I have the word, I just, you know, I have a, there's kind of a Platonic idea behind it, or there's at least something in the something floating around in the mind that it refers to, and it can't just be dispositional. It's got to be there in some sense. But I think that's probably not the way it works.
Yeah. So he could be talking, instead of dispositionally, about the qualia that an instantiation. I think there is a technical term for this, but I'm not remembering what it is offhand. The an occurrent belief. That's what I mean. An occurrent belief, an occurrent desire, it is happening right now. It is a content of consciousness. That would be just like a pain. That's something that you should be aware of. And it seems like you couldn't be wrong about it, even though maybe you could misunderstand what it entails or how it relates to the world or things like that.
So I believe that the cat is on the mat because my wife told me that, and I'm not thinking about it. Right. And yeah, we have to divide this into two, right? Because I could believe it without even being thinking about it. It's just a belief that I carry around. Then I could attend to the belief. But in any case, I don't need images necessarily to attend to the belief. And then there's the question, you know, if I'm wrong, if I've been lied to and I've just believed it, okay, that's fine. But I'm not, I could say, but I wasn't wrong that I believed that. So that's the authority at work with a propositional attitude, just for listeners. So. All right.
All propositional attitudes exhibit first-person authority, but in various degrees and kinds. Belief and desire are relatively clear and simple examples. It seems like they're not, based on what we were just saying. What do you really desire, anyway? While intention, perception, and memory and knowledge are in one way or another more complex. Thus, in evaluating someone's claim to have noticed that the house is on fire, there are at least three things to consider. Whether the house is on fire, whether the speaker believes the house is on fire, and how the fire caused the belief. So he's not engaging in methodological solipsism, like at least at this point.
If the fire sets your propositional attitudes on fire, then it causes the belief that it's on fire.
I mean, so, maybe I can only think if I write stuff down, then my propositional attitudes, I have no memory. With respect to the first, right, that the house is on fire, the speaker has no special authority. With respect to the second, he does. And with respect to the third, responsibility is mixed and complex, right? Whether the house being on fire caused my belief.
Or how it caused it.
Yep. The question whether someone intends to lock the door by turning the key depends in part on whether he wants to lock the door and believes that turning the key will lock the door, and whether this belief and desire have caused, in the right way, a desire to turn the key. Special authority attaches directly to claims about the desire and belief, less directly to claims about the necessary causal connection. These differences among the ways in which first-person authority may apply to propositional attitudes are important and worth exploring. But in every case, first-person authority is relevant, and it is the general case I wish to consider now. Since in almost every instance, if not all, first-person authority rests at least partially on a belief component, I shall concentrate on the case of belief.
All right. Even though he's going to concentrate on belief, what is he saying about the causal thing being mixed? How does that work? You want to explain that to me?
Insofar as it has to do with my belief, then it seems that I have special knowledge about it, right? If I think
the belief is fine, but I'm saying he's saying, yeah, we have authority with regard to the belief, right? I believe that the house is on fire, but the causal account, how it was caused, he says, is a complicated, right? So there's two kind of poles. I have authority that I believe the house is on fire. Is it really on fire? No authority. It might not be on fire. But then there's this middle realm of the causal where I think, yeah, I believe it because it is.
Well, maybe it's because I have other beliefs.
He's saying that's neither fully authoritative nor not, right?
Right. I believe that I have observed, I've smelled the smoke, I have seen the fire, I have felt the heat of the fire, and have every reason to believe that I'm next to the relevant house. So that was in my proposition. So it seems like I have been witness to the causal story. Again, I could be wrong about it, just like I could be wrong about the house being on fire. But part of the story is a story of the connection between my beliefs.
Less directly to claims about necessary causal. Why necessary causal connection? Why would that be necessary? All right. Well, he's not going to talk about that, so I guess we have to...
I mean, maybe this is going back to the papers that we read of him, that if you say a motivation, a reason is a cause, so...
Oh, a covering law? But he doesn't think that you need a covering
law.
Well,
they're not covering... Yeah, so maybe the necessary is still throwing me, that... I believe that the house is on fire because I have a perception that the house is on fire. So, you know, why do you think the house is on fire? Because I saw it. Is that that's not like a reason. It's not an intention because this is not philosophy of action, but the action is my uttering the phrase, you know, in response to your question that the house is on fire, and my reason is the epistemic warrant. So it seems like I have some, is it a necessary causal connection? You know, mental things.
So causality, he does think you need, at least under some description, right, for there to be a cause, mm-hmm. a covering law under at least some description, not all descriptions. So that would be necessity. So, all right, that's a whole other.
Page 3.
Thing about the nature of causality, yeah. Though there is first-person authority with respect to beliefs and other propositional attitudes, error is possible. This follows from the fact that the attitudes are dispositions, that manifest themselves in various ways and over a span of time. Error is possible, so is doubt. So we do not always have indubitable or certain knowledge of our own attitudes. Give me some examples, please. Nor are our claims about our own attitudes incorrigible. It is possible for the evidence available to others to overthrow self-judgments. Come on, dude. Let's have some examples.
You claim to believe in God, But the fact that you just ran from that bear instead of saying, God will protect me, that means you actually don't believe in God. That's a complicated one.
Being into psychoanalysis, I should have all sorts of examples of it, right? Yeah. What do we believe?
Do you really believe in Australia? I mean, right. You've heard a lot about Australia, but if you haven't been there, do you really believe in Australia? Or do you suspect maybe this is an elaborate joke?
This gets into self-deception as well, which I've always wanted to do. Show on, right? How do we deceive ourselves? And we think we believe certain things that deep down, right? There's got to be a weird kind of contradiction within us, because to deceive ourselves, mm-hmm. some part of us must know the truth. Otherwise, it wouldn't be self-deception. We'd just be wrong. But yeah, we can have certain... But I don't know if that's what he's talking about, though. I guess we'll find out.
It comes closer to characterizing first-person authority to note that the self-attributor does not normally base his claims on evidence or observation. Nor does it normally make sense to ask the self-attributor why he believes he has the beliefs, desires, or intentions he claims to have. This feature of self-attributions was marked by Wittgenstein. Here's a quote, "What is the criterion for the redness of an image? For me, when it is someone else's image, what he says or does. For myself, when it is my image, nothing." So that was from the investigations. Most philosophers have followed Wittgenstein in this and have extended the criterion to the propositional attitudes, as we shall see.
Yeah, so the criterion for the redness of an image. So if we ask you, you say, well, what's the question here? If you say that's a red apple.
Why do you think that you have a red?
Is it why do you think, or is it why? Yeah, what makes it? Yeah, okay, why do you think? Okay. Why do you think it's red? And you say, well, look, it's red.
But you can't, because it's in your head. We're talking about the idea, the idea of
so
red.
So why do you...
In your private red after, you know, when you're imagining red.
Why is your little qualia red? It just is. Or why are you having that qualia? I don't know.
Well, while you're having it, there might be... Because I asked you about it. I mean... You probably know.
Also because it, or you because saw of it, a brain or? State, you could appeal to a brain state. But yeah. All right, let's read on. This feature of first-person authority, suggestive as it may be, does not help explain the authority. This is so partly because of the caveats. Normally, we do not make self-attributions on the basis of evidence, but sometimes we do. He put normally in quotes there. Usually, in quotes... It doesn't make sense to ask someone why he believes he has a certain belief or desire or intention, but sometimes it does. Even in the exceptional cases, however, first-person authority persists. Even when a self-attribution is in doubt or a challenge is proper, the person with the attitude speaks about it with special weight. True.
But the existence of exceptions is not the chief reason first-person authority isn't explained by the fact that self-attributions are not based on evidence. The chief reason is simply that claims that are not based on evidence do not in general carry more authority than claims that are based on evidence, nor are they more apt to be correct. So that's a fun little, I gave evidence why I think that you were thinking of red, right? I asked you to think of red. I showed you a red swatch. Those are good, but I just know I'm thinking, I don't have any reason that I can give you. So why is, you know, clearly we think that I'm more warranted in talking about my own state, but I just gave evidence in the latter case and not in this case. So it seems like it should be the other way around.
Contemporary philosophers who have discussed first-person authority have made little attempt to answer the question why self-ascriptions are privileged. It is long out of fashion to explain self-knowledge on the basis of introspection, and it is easy to see why, since this explanation only leads to the question of why we should see any better when we inspect our own minds than when we inspect the minds of others. Seems pretty obvious to me, but all right, go ahead.
Well, we've introduced with this long journey into Hegel the idea that, you know, our self-conception, are really having a full mental life might rely on the social. And I was saying at the beginning of this on language in particular. So maybe you could think that, right? It's a Wittgensteinian thought that until we learn the language games, then you don't know whether you're thinking about red, right? You might see a bunch of red things and you might remember those things later, but you don't, until we've talked about it and identified that word red or rojo or whatever language you're using, then you don't really have that concept, as opposed to, you know, much less, you know, all the huge variations of colors that people who work in paint stores or fabric stores or whatever, you know, have to, I don't know the difference between teal and vermilion or whatever until I talk to somebody about that, even though like I could, yeah, I would probably just say they're both. That's not a great example, but
isn't vermilion red or something?
They're both red. See, they both have red involved.
Teal is blue green.
Yeah, okay, that's why it's not a good example. Anyway, there's navy blue
are you colorblind
and sky blue.
Well, those are pretty far apart. I mean, I think we you'd have to pick something close.
Lavender and sky blue. Anyway,
lavender and light purple. How do you distinguish them?
All right. Yes. A few philosophers have denied that the asymmetry exists. Ryle is a sturdy example. In The Concept of Mind, Ryle suggests that what we take for privileged access is due to nothing more than the fact that we are generally better placed to observe ourselves than others are. Ryle writes, in principle, as distinct from practice, ways of finding out about John Doe are the same as John Doe's finding out about Richard Roe. He continues, the differences are differences of degree, not kind. The superiority of the speaker's knowledge of what he's doing over that of the listener does not indicate that he has privileged access to facts of a type inevitably inaccessible to the listener, but only that he's in a very good position to know what the listener is often in a very poor position to know. The turns taken by a man's conversation do not startle or perplex his wife as much as they had surprised and puzzled his fiancée. Nor do close colleagues have to explain themselves to each other as much as they have to explain themselves to their new pupils. I take it you have nothing good to say about Ryle.
No, I mean, I don't understand this fully, but the idea here, right, yeah, is that, well, he's against privileged authority, first-person authority, so we find out about our own states of mind in the way that we find out about others, not because we are inside them and that they're immediately accessible to us, but because we are making inferences, I suppose.
I agree with Ryle that any attempt to explain the asymmetry between first person present tense claims about attitudes an other person or other tense claims by reference to a special way of knowing or a special kind of knowledge must lead to a skeptical result. Any such account must accept the asymmetry, but cannot explain it. But Ryle neither accepts nor explains the asymmetry. He simply denies that it exists. Since I think it is obvious that the asymmetry exists, I believe it is a mistake to argue from the absence of a special way of knowledge or a special mode or kind of knowledge to the absence of special authority. Instead, we should look for another source in the asymmetry. You know, he set this up by talking about dispositions. And if it's really, do you know if you're man enough to not run away from the bear? Like, well, I'm in a better, that seems like a good Rylean candidate because I'm around myself all the time. So I'll get to see, if a bear comes upon me or something comparable, mm-hmm. I'll be right there to witness it. Whereas you might not have all the relevant evidence, but still I'm observing my own behavior, mm-hmm. my own reactions, and you would mm-hmm. be doing so too. If we want if we want to talk about our current beliefs and like, what are you thinking? Are you thinking that I look bad in this dress? Well, it seems like you have a fundamentally different kind of access to your own opinion of the other person mm-hmm. in the dress than the person who's asking the question has.
Yeah, because if she knew what you really thought, that'd be held back.
All right,
obviously
keep going.
You're gonna lie. All right, Ayer at one time took a line similar to Ryle's. In The Concept of a Person, He emphasizes that first-person descriptions can be in error, and he allows that such descriptions are privileged. Okay. But let's look at the footnote. That's
it's
just
A.J. Ayer's Privacy from 1963.
Okay. But when he comes to describe the authority of self-ascriptions, he compares it to the authority we sometimes allow an eyewitness when compared with secondhand reports. This analogy seems to me unsatisfactory for two reasons. First, it fails to tell us why a person is like an eyewitness with respect to his own mental states and events while others are not. And second, it does not suggest an accurate description of what first-person authority is like. For first-person, attributions are not based on better evidence, but often, at least, on no evidence at all. Yeah, that contradicts Ryle as well. But the authority of the eyewitness is at best based on inductive probabilities easily overridden in particular cases. An eyewitness is discredited and his evidence discounted if he is a notoriously unreliable observer, prejudiced, or myopic. But a person never loses his special claim to be right about his own attitudes, even when his claim is challenged and overturned.
Why is that? Well, I guess if you want to say that there is a special claim, how could it ever be challenged and or overturned?
Yeah, we need an example of something being challenged and overturned. You know, I believe that you are mad at me. That's a complicated one because now it's a propositional attitude about someone else's mind. But, you know, I ran into your car because I believed that you were about to take a left because there is every evidence that you were about to do that, even though your turn signal wasn't on, your car was, you know. Now, could that be a fabricated, completely nonsense? You know, could that be false? And could you be deluding yourself that person was about to take a left? Of course you could be deluding yourself. It could just be nonsense. You could be rationalizing the fact that you're responsible for the accident.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't change the fact that you believe it. That's the authority. You believe the false thing, but you still believe it. To say that that's overturned, we have to say, well, there's a sense in which they didn't even believe it. They're wrong that they believed that. And that's about the past. And he doesn't want to get into memory.
I'm only lashing out because I'm
mad.
Of course,
we can be wrong about memory. So that's not a good example. Memory is a whole different thing. We can be wrong about memories of what we believed all the time. Yeah.
Let's just go on and see if he has an example. 105.
Gets so thorny, you know.
Agassiz, Andre Agassiz, who's this?
When he's not playing tennis.
Joseph Agassiz from Science
writing
in Flux,
his papers.
1975. Yeah. Agassiz has actually maintained that we know the mental states and events in other minds better than we know those in our own mind. That is the Hegel point. He distinguishes privileged access from the common sense truth that, quote, every person has access to some information available to that person alone, and it involves oneself, at least as an eyewitness. He goes on, the doctrine of privileged access is that I am the authority on all my own experiences. The thesis was refuted by Freud. I know your dreams better than you. Duhem, I know your methods.
Okay, this is not, right, but go ahead.
What? How do you pronounce Duhem?
No. Okay. Just what he's saying is right.
But I still don't know if I'm pronouncing Duhem right.
I don't know either, but.
Dwayne?
But maybe you do know. You don't know, you know.
So Duhem's is, I know your methods of scientific discovery better than you. Malinowski, his would be, I know your customs and habits better than you. And perception theorists, I can make you see things which are not there and describe your perceptions better than you can. These are all from Agassiz.
This, okay. Yeah, this doesn't make any sense to me. It's not, Freud doesn't know your dreams better than you. You had the dream and he can give you a theory of what the wish is in the dream or, you know, theory of what the meaning of the dream is. But that's not the same as the phenomenological qualitative content of the dream. He doesn't have. So I don't get that. But anyway, go ahead, because he's about to comment on this.
Aside from Freud's case, there's little here to threaten first-person authority. Freud's views, by extending the concepts of intention, belief, desire, and the rest to include the unconscious, do not mean that with respect to some propositional attitudes, a person loses direct authority. Indeed, loss of authority is the main distinguishing feature of unconscious mental states. Of course, the pre-Freudian attitudes remain as subject as ever to first-person authority. But more interesting is the fact that in psychoanalytic practice, recovery of authority over an attitude is often considered the only solid evidence that the attitude was there before being non-inferentially appreciated by its holder. Thus, those cases of unconscious...
So in other words, the unconscious becomes conscious.
But yep. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Thus, those cases of unconscious mental states that were unsystematically recognized to exist before Freud are indirectly included in the scope of first-person authority by psychoanalysis. So I do not think the existence of unconscious attitudes threatens the importance of first-person authority.
I agree with that, but what is this, the sentence before that mean? Unconscious mental states that were unsystematically recognized, right? So he's just saying, yeah, I believe that's true. Also, people recognized and even wrote about the unconscious before Freud, less systematically, but they're indirectly included in the scope of first-person authority. So unconscious mental states are included in the scope? We don't have authority on what our unconscious mental states are.
So I wonder, you know, you were giving the example before of this a possible rationalization of why you honked at the person, this traffic incident. And I think that is entirely, you know, of a piece with what we read about him in the other articles for the Partial Examined Life episode, which is that we have a special epistemic access to our own intentions, even though we're very commonly wrong about them. So I flipped the switch because I wanted to turn on the light. But, you know, there's some room for, or, you know, I signaled because I wanted to make a turn. Well, if that was like a so programmed, right, you didn't think even for a second, you know, I it's just part of my deal that I turn on the turn signal when I'm going to make a turn. Do I always want to say that, like, yes, I wanted to make a turn, and so I turned on the turn? I guess so, but I'm certainly, am I conscious of a wanting there? I don't know.
Yeah, I think often we're not, and Freud would call these pre-conscious rather than unconscious, because I could become conscious of it at any time if I attended to it. But yeah, often it's below the level of conscious awareness. And when I do the turn signal, it's completely habit. You know, is some little homunculus in me conscious of it? I think so. They're doing their thing,
yes.
Module.
It has access consciousness, but even if it is not something you are aware of. Here's a question for you, Wes. Do you not use your turn signal when you are absolutely sure that no one is around to see it?
Well, I don't. And I even, you know, driving in Boston, I stopped using it because it was just going to, I didn't want to clue other people into what I was doing because I knew they were going to try and get in my way. And aggressive. If you're driving in an aggressive environment, you don't want people to know what you're going to do. So I use it when it's warranted. I use it when it's going to yield the best outcome.
Yeah. When I use a turn signal, is it because I want to turn? I mean, there's nothing essential about it. It's very conveniently located, especially when you're turning right, to just click it, you know. But often I might do it as I'm turning, because that is actually the movement of your hand as you flip it up
that
to the right
that really
as you start to turn.
People do that.
I guess the left, it works as well, because you're pushing it down and you're turning to the left. Or is it because you want a signal, or just because you don't want to get a ticket? Like, I don't actually think this is in this circumstance. Certainly, if I'm in a turn-only lane, or there's multiple turn-only lanes, right? And you're in the leftmost of them, so you're definitely going to turn. I'm not going to sit there with the turn signal on while we're waiting for the light for 3 minutes, because I just don't want to hear that fucking thing. All right, I'm leading too much into this.
But I think this is over. Yeah, it's overdetermined. There's a lot of different motivations. Mm-hmm. They're below the level of conscious awareness. They're non-conscious. You know, you may have gotten a lot of tickets. You've been burned many times, so you habitually do the turn signal. You may be a person who's just very, very concerned about safety. That may be another reason. that doesn't explain why you would not use your turn signal in the past. Maybe you became, worried about safety after, because you got in an accident. So there's that reason. Your family has been nagging you about it, and you don't want to hear them bitch. So that's another reason. And this is what Freud calls over the determination. You could load up all these different reasons, and it's hard to say which is the one, is there one reason why you did it? But in any case, all the reasons at that operating moment, you're so habituated to doing something. They're right. They're you know how Aristotle distinguishes the two senses of belief, right? There's the belief that I have right now, or the current, I think you called it. And then there's the belief that I just have when I'm not even thinking about it. I don't believe in Santa Claus. I don't have to be thinking about not believing in Santa Claus to not believe about him, but I can have the current belief right now that he doesn't exist, right? So in the same way, and so what are those sort of dispositional beliefs that are more in the realm of potentiality? Yeah, they're more like character. They're just they're things that are written into us that are below the level of the mental or on the border of the mental. But anyway, I don't quite understand what he knows, but it means to say that we have privileged access to our unconscious mental states, except that we can't really know that they were unconscious, our unconscious mental states, until an analyst has helped us make the unconscious conscious. And then we say, oh, that's the mental state. That's the belief that I had all along. Now I see it. Now I know it.
Well, that's okay. This is why I was bringing this up, because I feel like in any intention claim, you could be wrong about it. It could be a post hoc rationalization, but that doesn't mean that you don't still have a primary epistemic advantage in accessing your own intentions as compared to somebody else. And I think the same thing would go to your own unconscious contents. That's like your any disposition that you didn't know you were afraid, that you had this scarring incident that made you desperately afraid of horses or whatever, because your dad once dressed as a horse and beat the shit out of you. That you've repressed, but yet you have at least potential access to that. You experienced it in a way that nobody else does.
It's funny because there's Little Hands, a famous Freudian case where he's afraid of horses, and it does have something to do with his father, but the connection is much more subtle. But yeah, it would be
Yes,
far simpler if
that's
his
the thing I
father had
was
just
half
beat the shit
remembering.
out of him dressed as a horse. But anyway, I turn now to philosophers who have assumed that there is such a thing as first person authority and have accepted Wittgenstein's description of the difference between first and third person attributions.
Strawson discusses first-person authority in the context of trying to answer skepticism about other minds, and this, of course, is P.F. Strawson, not Galen Strawson. According to Strawson, if the skeptic understands his own question, how does anyone know what is going on in someone else's mind? He knows the answer. For if the skeptic knows what a mind is, he knows it must be in a body and that it has thoughts. He also knows that we attribute thoughts to others on the basis of observed behavior, but to ourselves without such a basis. Strawson writes, this is from 1959, his book Individuals, which is something that I kind of want to read. In order to have this type of concept of a mental property, one must be both a self-ascriber and an other-ascriber of such predicates, which ascribe mental properties, and must see every other as a self-ascriber. In order to understand this type of concept, one must acknowledge that there is a kind of predicate which is unambiguously and adequately ascribable both on the basis of observation of the subject of predicate and not on that basis that is independently of observation of the subject.
Wait, let me read that again. In
Yeah, I
order to
didn't
understand
follow
this type
that.
of concept, one must acknowledge that there is a kind of predicate which is unambiguously and adequately ascribable both on the basis of observation of the subject of predicate and not on that basis, independently of the observation of the subject. So, observation being like observing my mo own mental states from the
Yes.
inside, I think. So, it's, yeah. So, there's these certain these mental predicates, and we ascribe them on two bases.
behavioral right,
there's
and
the
direct.
Self-ascription, yep. And then the direct, and then the behavioral for other people. But he's saying that I need both to even have the concept.
Right. That's what the language
I
game
couldn't
is.
Ascribe them to myself unless I were capable of them ascribing them to others. And we do get support from this, right? Because it's right. There's the Hegelian point about recognition, you know, knowing myself through the eyes of the other, basically. And then there's Thomas Scitello and joint attention and all of that stuff where to have a theory of mind, I have to, and to have a theory of my own mind, I have to be thinking of the other as thinking of my mind and sharing objects of attention and things like that. Sorry, that's a really terrible explanation of all that, but you get the idea.
This cannot be deemed a satisfactory answer to the skeptic, for the skeptic will reply that though Strawson may have correctly described the asymmetry between first and other person ascriptions of mental predicates, he has done nothing to explain it. In the absence of an explanation, the skeptic is certainly justified in asking how we know that the description is correct. In particular, why should we think that a predicate is sometimes applied on the basis of observation and sometimes not is unambiguous? This question, to which Strawson has not addressed himself, is the source of skepticism about knowledge of other minds. Right. So it sounds like if you want to use this Wittgenstein language game talk, it seems like you can only talk about the intersubjective. You can't talk about your relation to yourself. But I'm not sure if that's the case, because part of my addressing you is to say, I know that I have this belief and I'm observing it. So you might say that the direct observation is not actually part of the language game, but reference to the direct observation is part of the language game. And it's part of the definition of to be in pain, because that's easiest. That if I say that I'm in pain and you understand that, then you know both your own experience of observing your own pain and you know how you tell that other people are in pain. You know, that these are, even though you can't see the self-ascription of my self-ascription of pain, you know in your own case, and so therefore it's part of the language game.
All right. Well, we have 1 minute.
I think
47 seconds to wrap up here.
Let's not start on the rest of this. We are pretty much exactly halfway through the article, so we'll do this one more time. And so far, it's not been intolerably analytic.
He's good. I enjoy Davidson a lot, actually. And I like the slow build. You notice that? He just sort of, it's like a suspense movie. It's like a thriller or something. You know, we know something is coming. There's something in the basement. Oh, that's a horror film. Anyway.
I mean, we did have an abstract.
He hasn't arrived yet, and he just, you know, builds.
Let me look again.
What's he going to say about this?
Let's look again at the abstract, the summary of the whole thing. What explains the presumption that a speaker is right when he sincerely attributes a belief, desire, or intention to his present self, when there's no such presumption when others make it? It is argued that solutions, quote unquote, to the problem of knowledge of other minds, which merely restate the asymmetry, leave open the field to the skeptic. A new explanation of first person authority is offered, which traces the source of the authority to a necessary feature of the interpretation of speech.
Gives you a general idea, but he's into no spoilers, man. You don't put spoilers up front. It's a Davidson paper.
Still, is that a summary? That's not a summary like a newspaper article summary. It should tell you. It should characterize
it. If he told you up front, you wouldn't need to read the paper, probably.
All right. We'll see y'all next time. Remember, if you are seeing this on the public feed, which we've now successfully transferred to our own site, so it will not disappear despite my warnings in the past, you should sign up for our Patreon, patreon.com/closereadsphilosophy, and that will get you part two. Otherwise, we will assume you don't care about the suspense. You've had enough of this. And in a month from now, you'll hear us start another, or no, 2 weeks from now, you'll hear us start another thing. Sometimes it's a month, but it won't be in this case. All right. Thanks, Wes.
Bye,
everybody.